Javan, all that. Artaha is meant. Udapane, in a well of water. Sarvataha, in all respects. Sampluta utake, in a great reservoir of water. Tavan, similarly. Sarveshu, in all. Vedeshu, Vedic literatures. Brahmanasya, of the man who knows the Supreme Brahman. Vijanatha, who is in complete knowledge. Translation, all purposes served by a small well can at once be served by a great reservoir of water. Similarly, all the purposes of the Vedas can be served to one who knows the purpose behind them. So you can repeat. All purposes served by a small well can at once be served by a great reservoir of water. Similarly, all the purposes of the Vedas can be served to one who knows the purpose behind them. So, purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. The rituals and sacrifices mentioned in the Karma Kanda division of the Vedic literature are meant to encourage gradual development of self-realization. And the purpose of self-realization is clearly stated in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, 15:15. The purpose of studying the Vedas is to know Lord Krishna, the primeval cause of everything. So self-realization means understanding Krishna and one's eternal relationship with Him. The relationship of the living entities with Krishna is also mentioned in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavad Gita 15th chapter, text 7. The living entities are parts and parcels of Krishna. Therefore, revival of Krishna consciousness by the individual living entity is the highest perfectional stage of Vedic knowledge. This is confirmed in the Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd canto, 33rd chapter, text 7, as follows. Aho bhatasva pachito garihan yajivagre vartate namatupyam te putstapaste duhuva shashnurarya brahmanuchurnama grananti yate. O my Lord, a person who is chanting your holy name, although born of a low family like that of a chandala, dog eater, is situated on the highest platform of self-realization. Such a person must have performed all kinds of penances and sacrifices according to Vedic rituals and studied the Vedic literatures many, many times after taking his bath in all the holy places of pilgrimage. Such a person is considered to be the best of the Aryan family. So one must be intelligent enough to understand the purpose of the Vedas without being attached to the rituals only, and must not desire to be elevated to the heavenly kingdoms for a better quality of sense gratification. It is not possible for the common man in this age to follow all the rules and regulations of the Vedic rituals, nor is it possible to study all of the Vedanta and the Upanishads thoroughly. It requires much time, energy, knowledge, and resources to execute the purposes of the Vedas. This is hardly possible in this age. The best purpose of Vedic culture is served, however, by chanting the holy name of the Lord, as recommended by Lord Chaitanya, the deliverer of all fallen souls. When Lord Chaitanya was asked by a great Vedic scholar, Prakashananda Sarasvati, why he, the Lord, was chanting the holy name of the Lord like a sentimentalist instead of studying Vedanta philosophy, the Lord replied that his spiritual master had found him to be a great fool and thus asked him to chant the holy name of Lord Krishna. He did so and became ecstatic like a madman. In this age of Kali, most of the population is foolish and not adequately educated to understand Vedanta philosophy. The best purpose of Vedanta philosophy is served by inoffensively chanting the holy name of the Lord. Vedanta is the last word in Vedic wisdom, and the author and knower of the Vedanta philosophy is Lord Krishna. And the highest Vedantist is the great soul who takes pleasure in chanting the holy name of the Lord. That is the ultimate purpose of all Vedic mysticism. All right, read the verse again. Yavanartho tapane sarvatasam sutaruke tavan sarveshu vedeshu brahmanasya vijanataka. So om gana tividandasya gananjana shulakaya chakshur and meditam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. All right, so we use this word Veda quite a bit, and also Vedic. Isn't it? We say certain things are Vedic, certain things are not Vedic. So we're going to try to give you a brief overview of what Veda means. Veda actually means knowledge, but I'm going to explain practically how that applies to us. Many times we think things are Vedic are not Vedic. They're just cultural things. And this may come as a surprise to all of you. Like a dhoti, for example, is not Vedic. It's a culture. It's a cultural thing. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying it's good. I'm not putting a value on a dhoti or a sari, okay? But it's coming from a certain culture, a certain place in India, because certain places in India, they wear different style dhotis. South India, they don't have the kacha. You know what a kacha is? That means the tail. You brahmacharis and grihasthas, you have a little tail on your dhoti. It's not like the dog's tail. It's a piece you wrap underneath and you tuck in the back. Therefore, it's called a tail. But in South India, they don't have that. They just wear it's like a lungi. That's what they wear. You know, it's like a long lungi. So for example, I have some disciples who come from South India and they attend initiation and they're not wearing a Bengali dhoti. They're wearing South Indian dhoti. And I don't say, that's Maya, that's not Vedic. So, and also, you know, the style of tilak is something that's due to the culture. Like in South India, it's wider tilak. We have Gaudiya Vaishnava tilak is like that. Hairstyle. I mean, a lot of things. Like even the way I'm dressed as a sannyasi is not even a tradition, what to speak of Vedic. Our tradition in the Gaudiya Sampradaya is that sannyasis would dress in a gumsha, like a short dhoti. Like that. Goswamis in Vrindavan didn't walk around like this. You see pictures of the Goswami? You have a picture on the altar? Yeah, you have a picture on the altar. They're wearing white. That doesn't mean they're married. You know, when I was a young brahmachari, when someone got married, we used to say they were all bleached out. They lost all their blood. Anyways, so, you know, we used to be fanatic brahmacharis many years ago. So the Goswamis in Vrindavan, they're wearing these white things. So that's what was done 500 years ago. So, in other words, it's not Vedic; it's a tradition, and even the kurta that we all wear, or the men at least, that didn't come from India. That's from Afghanistan. That's an Islamic thing, tradition. Did you know that? I hate to destroy your illusions, you know. That's actually where it's from. I mean, if you go to Afghanistan or something, you'll see people wearing kurtas. And they didn't get it from India. So a while ago, there was, when we were discussing on how to build the temple in Mayapur, you know, Temple of Vedic Planetarium, there are many people proposing we need a more Vedic design. Right? Remember that? Yeah, and they were complaining about the present design. I mean, I'm not saying anything about designs because I'm not an architect. So, but there is no evidence of Vedic design in India. That may come as a shock, too, because all the temples, none of them are that old, to go back to what they call the Vedic period, you know, 5,000 years old. And the oldest temples in India, temple room looks more or less like this, with a lot of pillars in it. If you've ever been to South India, like Srirangam, for example, They have this room at this temple where the Alvars would meet. Anyone's heard of the Alvars before? The Alvars were the poetic, South Indians who were great Vaishnavas, devotees of Lord Vishnu, and they wrote a lot of poetry. Incidentally, some of the Alvars were ladies too. So also chauvinism is not Vedic. So it's interesting. That's something more modern. What's Vedic? Anyway, so this is an interesting discussion. So in those temples, it's the hall of 1,000 pillars where the Alvars met. And it's literally just pillars everywhere because that was the architecture at that time. Is that Vedic? I don't know. What is Vedic? I mean, of course you have some supplementary Vedic literatures that deal with certain aspects of architecture. And we're not going to get into that. But really, they don't describe the style of the building. So what is Vedic? And actually, they're more modern literature. So the Ayurveda is more modern. The Jyotir Shastras are more modern. All these supplementary literatures are more modern than the four Vedas. So really, we consider a lot of things to be Vedic that may or may not be Vedic, right? I mean, we don't know. And then, all right, let's talk about the four Vedas. You got the Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda, Yajur Veda. Those are the four Vedas. But actually, before that, there was one Veda. And that Veda was divided into four by Vyasadev. And in fact, that's what the word Vyasadev means. Vyas, if you study Sanskrit, means to divide. And Samas means to put together. Does everyone understand that? So Vyasadeva took the one Veda and divided it into four. And those four Vedas are, as Krishna states in the Gita, mainly dealing with the modes of nature. He says, Trigunya Vishaya Veda Nich Trigunya Bhavarjuna Nirdvandvo Nidvasatrasto Niryoga Kshema Atmavan. He says to Arjuna, because Arjuna is very interested in being Vedic. Arjuna is quoting from the Vedas in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, right? He's saying, look what's going to happen. If you killed all these men, does anyone know what's going to happen? What does Arjuna say? Then something will happen and then something else will happen. Does anyone know Bhagavad Gita here? If all the men are killed, what will happen? The women will not be protected. And therefore the family traditions will not be upheld. And society will, and there'll be unwanted progeny. This is a Vedic argument. I mean, something from the original Vedas. And Krishna says, basically, he says to Arjuna that these Vedas are meant for those in the modes of nature. Trigunya Vishaya Veda are meant for those in illusion. In other words, they don't really concentrate they're not focused on the ultimate goal of self-realization or the ultimate goal of life. What they're focused on is preliminary steps, Trigunya Vishaya Veda, Nish Trigunya. You should rise above these things, Arjuna. Nirdvandvo, you don't get into this duality. Nirdvandvo Nidvashakushto. Be established in goodness, transcendental goodness. Niryonga Shema Atmavan. Be established in the self. In your real self, in your relationship to the super self. So that's Krishna's statement in the Gita. So anyway, so the four Vedas, just to describe briefly what they do, you have the Yajur Veda, which is the Veda of yagyas, sacrifices. Ananta asked me to do a sacrifice on Sunday. He says, I like the way you do sacrifices. They're so quick. That's probably because I don't know anything about sacrifice. I just do swaha, 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 you're married. I do the way Prabhupada taught us, which is very simple because it's not Kali Yuga. Sacrifices are not the Yuga Dharma. The Yuga Dharma is Krishna Nam, Sankirtan. So I remember that. So anyway, so Yajur Veda, Sama Veda has the different musical let us say, arrangements and rhythms by which the mantras are to be chanted. So that's the Samaveda. Atharvaveda is interesting. It's a Veda of different weapons, like the Brahmastra weapon. You understand the Brahmastra? Where you can fire a weapon and kill someone. So that's the Atharvaveda. So all these Vedas, and of course then there's the Rig Veda. I forgot about the Rig Veda. Rig Veda is the Veda of the hymns itself. And of course the most famous verse from the Rig Veda that Prabhupada would quote very often is Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Pada Pashanti Yad Surya. That all the demigods, they're looking at Vishnu. But people don't read that verse for that much. They think that they're meant to sacrifice to the demigods. Anyway, so you have those Vedas. And then, a little history, and I've spoken about this before. Those Vedas were misused by the Brahmanas. And so then you have the other Shrutis that occurred after that, which are the, Shruti means that, which is heard. Then after that you have the Upanishads. And the Upanishads, actually, does anyone know what Upanishad means? Nobody knows.
Bringing closer.
Yeah, to bring it closer, to come closer to the spiritual master. Or basically, bow down, mister. You know, put it in common language, you know, Boy George language. Bow down, mister. Hare Krishna, Hare Ram. Anyway, so the Upanishads, I mean, they're dealing with some transcendental subject matters. And then also you have other Aranyaka literatures, which are other secondary literatures, which were written or spoken by those who lived in the forest. Aranyaka means the forest, those who live in the forest. And then after the Upanishads, you have something called the Vedanta Sutra, Brahma Sutra. And the Vedanta, you've heard about it many times before, is written in short statements, but the Vedanta verses refer to specific verses. Each verse in the Vedanta refers to specific verses in the Upanishads. Everybody understands that? It's like, but it's meant for more intelligent people because they're codes. They're written in very short verses, so that people who are intelligent will understand what they're saying, like Atato Brahma Gyasa. Now's the time to look for the absolute truth. If you're not intelligent, you're not going to know what to do about that. If I say to you, all right, go look for the absolute truth, you'll say, you know, where should I look for it? In Govindas. Or on the altar. You know, yeah, you won't know where to look because it's meant for more intelligent people. Or Janma Jasya Yataha. The absolute truth is that from which everything comes. So these are statements, different statements in the Vedanta. And then after the Vedanta, you have these commentaries on the Vedanta. Commentaries, of course, the Srimad Bhagavatam we consider to be a Gaudiya commentary on the Vedanta. But you have commentaries like the Sharirakya Bhasha commentary, written by Shripad Raman, not Raman, Shankaracharya, and Ramanujacharya's commentary, the Sri Bhasha. And then you have our Gaudiya commentary, the Govinda Bhasha, written by Baladeva Bijavushana. Anyway, Bhasha means a commentary. Or summary, something like that. So anyway, so you have all these commentaries written on the Vedanta. And of course, our main commentary is the Srimad Bhagavatam. So all these different literatures are meant ultimately, as Krishna states here, to bring one to the point of Krishna consciousness. So what does that mean for us? Does that mean that we just chant Hare Krishna and then Krishna will take care of everything else? You just become absorbed in Krishna's Vrindavan pastimes. And we don't have to worry about ordinary morality or ethics or being a nice guy. You know, it's just like we thought that in the beginning days of the movement, that we're devotees. It doesn't matter that there's a red light. You know, we're driving a car. Just go through it, you know. We have a right. That's our adhikar. It is our right. Transcendental degree, you know, all these other things that came along with being pure devotees of the Lord. And we all thought we were just on a very exalted platform of devotion. Well, that's a common problem. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur analyzes the sources of anarthas. And one of the sources is just being a devotee. There are other sources like offenses, pious activities, impious activities. There's four types of offenses. But just being a devotee creates anarthas. That's pretty interesting, isn't it? Just being a devotee. Why? Because you're given a very nice, perfect philosophy. But you're imperfect. It's like you take a soldier and you just join the army and you give him one of these drones to control. You know what a drone is? Unmanned aerial vehicle. You know how the Americans are shooting down everybody in Afghanistan using like a video game joystick? You don't know about that? Or forget, I won't talk about that. You haven't read the news. So I'll talk about something. So all right, so you get a soldier just joins the army, and you put him in the seat of a very sophisticated fighter jet. You know what a fighter jet is, I hope. You know, an F-4 or something. You say, okay, go for it. And of course, you know, he's all enthusiastic, like kids are. When I was young, you know, like 6 or 7 years old, I would make believe I was in an airplane and just do all sorts of things like that. So you put someone who's not trained, who's a completely new soldier, you give him a weapon, an advanced weapon. And what's going to happen? You say, just shoot anybody you want. You don't have to practice. Then it's the same thing as when you take a neophyte. That means a new person who likes to fight a lot. Neophyte. So you take a new person and you give them the highest philosophy whereby he can defeat anyone else. You know, he just becomes proud. He develops an anarthas. Or you put a neophyte on a vyasasan. Isn't it? I mean, just like, there's so many stories in the Vedic literatures how even innocent people, or let's say simple people, they took a high position, they became very proud. And then that pride led to the fall. So anyway, so that's a cause of anartha. So generally we think, you know, I just have to be Krishna conscious. I am Krishna. Not only do I have to be, I am Krishna conscious. That's a problem. If anyone thinks they are Krishna conscious, they're in trouble. Because they're playing with Maya. So I just have to be Krishna conscious. I just have to chant. And these other rules of morality, you know, be nice and kind to people. And helping old ladies cross streets. You know, and following rules like the golden rule, like do unto others, you would have others do unto you. Or being kind. No, that's not for me. So that makes one's heart very hard. You see, as far as the pure devotees are concerned, those who are actually pure devotees, they actually are compassionate and moral and ethical on all different levels. They don't act in ways that are contrary to ordinary morality. I mean, Prabhupada didn't do that, nor did the six Goswamis of Vrindavan do that. You just don't see that, at least in the modern age. It's one thing is if you have a government that's filled with demons, like Hiranyakashipu is in charge and you're Prahlad Maharaj, then you may sneak around teaching about Lord Vishnu. But Prahlad Maharaj was still respectful to his father. So it's very important for a devotee to cultivate the principles of ordinary morality and ethics, too. not only for his own sake, because he should be in the mode of goodness. You cannot become Krishna conscious unless you're cultivating the mode of goodness. It just doesn't work. If you're in passion or ignorance, you're just not going to be able to be Krishna conscious. So not only for his own sake, but for the sake of the reputation of the Krishna consciousness movement. Like Prabhupada was asked, what is the quality of your followers? And Prabhupada said, they're perfect ladies and gentlemen. You cannot find fault in them. So in other words, we should act as perfect ladies and gentlemen, respectable people in this world. And in this way, we can actually become Krishna conscious and influence others to come to Krishna consciousness. So this verse, of course, doesn't indicate that just because we know the purpose of the Vedas and we're executing the Sankirtan Yajna, we can ignore everything else. We have to be ladies and gentlemen and act compassionately and ethically and responsibly and legally in order to carry out Srila Prabhupada's mission. So, anyway, so that's all I'll speak about right now. Any questions or comments about any of these points? Oh? Yeah.
I actually heard in one lecture that Sanatana Goswami went to Braj Vasis and just asked them how they are.
Yes. Yes, he interacted with them like that. Yeah. The Sanatana Goswami would go, he asked, how's the business going? How's your family? It's not that he was just some agitated brahmachari, he just couldn't deal with anybody. Not just going, Hare Krishna, Maya, Maya. he was functioning at all different levels. One of the qualities of a pure devotee is daksha. He's expert in doing everything, materially and spiritually. So it's not that we just chant Hare Krishna. Of course, we do. That is our main activity, chanting Hare Krishna. But we should be moral, ethical, and concerned with other people. You know, if you see someone suffering, it's not that you should think that I'm a devotee and you're just, that's your karma, buddy. Sometimes people think like that. That's your karma. Ah, look at that person suffer. Ah, you're going to become a dog in your next life. I remember one time, this is before I understood a little bit about compassion, I said to one of my disciples who had a dog, I said, you're going to be a dog! And she said, I love my dog. I said, you're going to be a dog! You remember the story of Jad Bharat and Bharat Maharaj? See you next life. So that's a very uncompassionate thing to say. So we should have regular compassion for people. People will be attracted then. And people are attracted by loving exchanges, like Prabhupada talks about in the commentary to the Upadeshamrita. Tadati pratigranati guyam akirti prichati. And Prabhupada says, this way our movement expands by these six loving exchanges. Giving prasadam, accepting prasadam, giving gifts, accepting gifts, revealing the mind in confidence, and hearing from others in confidence. So this is confidence means empathically, compassionately. You know, not just hearing, okay, what do you have to say today? You're in Maya. That's not very empathic, you know. So I'm struggling with my senses. And you say, give it up. You know, so you have to be a little empathic, and not little, very empathic with people. And the movement will expand. People looking for loving exchanges with Krishna and with Krishna's devotees. That's the actual way to make devotees. Loving exchanges. Krishna conscious loving exchange. Obviously, we don't do things that are against the regulated principles. We don't invite everybody to a satsang and then take beer. I mean, that would be terrible, isn't it? What's your bhakti briksha like? It's really nice. We drink afterwards. So, any other questions or points? Yes.
What is the difference between relations, culture and tradition?
Culture and tradition? That's interesting. It's an interesting question. But tradition indicates something historical. It may be something that goes back many years, or it may be something that only goes back a few years, or maybe something that only goes back a few minutes. I mean, for example, you have a tradition here of having Mangal Arati at 5 o'clock in the morning, right? I like that tradition. It's much more sattvic than having Mangal Arati at 4:30. And it would be more sattvic to have Mangal Arati at 6 in the morning. But, you know, since I've been here, the tradition has been... That's a tradition. That's a tradition means some historical way and means of dealing with things. And a culture can be based on tradition, some history thing, or it can be something that's modern. It's means and ways of people communicating with each other, a way of dressing in a culture, shaking hands, just like in the West, when we meet someone, what do? We shake their hands. Nowadays, they do, what, high five? You have that here? Really? All the children know how to do that. High five. And in India, you go, namaste. That's part of it, one of the cultural things, or cultural way of looking at things, language is also culture. So they're intertwined, but they're slightly different. You know, tradition is always dealing with the past, and culture is what's happening right now. You can also say it's past culture, but a culture can be based on the past, or it can be based on something you just come up with right now. They're just the ways and means of people interacting, thinking, worshiping, whether it's traditional or not, is another issue.
You mentioned that some cultural things are not Vedic.
Some cultural things are not Vedic that we follow. They're not necessarily, I'm not saying they're bad. They actually help us with a sense of identity, like the Dodis help us with a sense of identity. That's not necessarily Vedic, a Dodi. I mean, there's no indication that Krishna wore Dodi in the battlefield of Kurukshetra. I think he would have tripped over himself, right? If Arjuna was wearing a Dodi. You know, obviously some sort of like pants or something closer to that he was wearing there. So, but it's not bad. It helps us have a sense of identity. Like this, like our Sikha, for example. In certain sampradayas, the Sikha is quite big. It covers up almost like a quarter of the head. And our Sikha, Prabhupada said, is like this. I've seen sometimes devotees, they get a bigger Sikha. And that Prabhupada would say, don't do that. That's not our tradition. Of course, some people can't have a Sikha because they've lost all their hair. But that's just that doesn't mean they can't go back to Godhead. You know, there was this myth in the early days of the movement that Krishna pulls you back to Godhead by your Sikha. And if you don't have a Sikha, you're not going back to Godhead. So I was thinking, you know, all the bald people, they're not going back to Godhead. And the women have a better chance of going back to Godhead. Because if I haven't tried to hang from my Sikha, I think we'd come out. So there's myths, too, you know, cultural myths, too. Prabhupada never said that. You know, Prabhupada never said, maybe jokingly he said, Krishna will take you back by your Sikha. But, you know, devotees made it into a big thing, you know. No. It's a tradition. It's based on Gaudiya Vaishnavism, and it's part of our culture, too. And it's good. It helps us with our sense of identification. But as far as being, you know, Vedic, it may be considered to be Vedic in the sense it helps us remember Krishna. But it's not something that from the ancient Vedic culture. There's a difference.
I have one definition of culture, that this is lifestyles which follows philosophy, which is based on the philosophy which we follow. If you follow like Vaishnava philosophy, it's like lifestyles which follow that support, which you mentioned.
Yeah, that's one definition, but you can also have cultures without any philosophy. You know, why do you do something? Well, that's, my mother did it. I guess that's a philosophy. You know, that's a philosophy, but it's, you know, there's a lot of cultures without a, a deep philosophical underpinning. Of course, we want to have a deep philosophical underpinning of our culture. But another point is that we're not going to make people Krishna conscious just by imposing the external aspects of our internal culture on them. Like if you, I mean, it's interesting in America that, you know, I hope I don't get in trouble. But in America, they have this thing called the Festival of India. But Americans don't want to become Indians. You know, Americans, I mean, even Indians don't want to become Indians anymore. I mean, they want to become Americans. So how much are people going to be attracted to Krishna consciousness just by the external things that are more culturally based or more ethnically based? I mean, is the question. You know, how many, will it actually attract people or not? But it's because it's not an eternal spiritual principle. I mean, one could be completely Krishna conscious wearing pants as much as one can be wearing dhoti. Of course, the principle, as far as I'm concerned, is following the order of Srila Prabhupada. That's why I wear a dhoti. I mean, that's an eternal principle, that you follow the order of the spiritual master and you dress according to what pleases him. I mean, that's another thing. That's another thing, which is not related. So what are we actually trying to give? We're trying to give people Krishna consciousness, which is based on the pure chanting of the holy name. We're not trying to get everybody in the world wearing dhoti. In fact, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, when he went to the court every day, he would wear a shirt pant. In other words, regular clothes, Western clothes. Another thing people call the Western clothes, sometimes they call it karmi clothes. It's like those are your fruitive clothes. It's neither karmic, you know, but there's plenty of people in India who wear dhotis who are vikarmis. But we do this because this is what Prabhupada wanted. Yes, I understand we're part of this particular tradition where we do this. But then on the other hand, when we're trying to spread Krishna consciousness all over the world, is it that we're trying to get people just to follow this aspect of the tradition? And if it's counterproductive, you know, people, and if people don't want to become Indians, you know, will they not accept Krishna consciousness? So anyway, these are all questions we have to ask. So what are the essential items of Krishna consciousness? And that's what we really have to understand and not take away from those. I mean, essential items are like Srimad Bhagavatam chanting. You know, the five principles, the five most important principles of devotional service or practices, what are they? Does anyone know? What? Srimad Bhagavatam. Living in a holy place. Chanting the holy name. Worshipping. Sadhusanga. You know, those are the five most important principles. I don't think anywhere in Rupa Goswami's books it lists wearing a dhoti as one of the most important principles. I'm not against it. I wear a dhoti all the time. Except, I mean, sometimes I don't. When I go to some official business or go to the embassy, like I went to the embassy. I mean, that's life, Hare Krishna. But I'm not against the principle if it helps my Krishna consciousness. But it's not listed by Rupa Goswami, which is interesting, isn't it? Now, tilak is, you know, marking your body. So tilak, that's why Prabhupada said it. If people are going to have some high position, they should keep wearing tilak and neck beads. So that's a spiritual principle. Tilak marking your body as a temple of God, and also keeping tulsi mala around your neck. These are essential spiritual principles. So I'm trying to separate the essential spiritual principles from certain traditional items that we can accept or not accept depending on whether it helps us remember Krishna or helps us propagate the Krishna consciousness movement or not. Does everyone understand that? It's an important point to understand.
So
what are the questions? Yeah.
Hare
Hare Krishna.
Please, could you tell us something about Srimati Tulasi Devi and Srimati Radharani? Are they non-different?
I'm just a neophyte. All I know is prasadam tastes nice. What else do I know as a neophyte? Chanting Hare Krishna is nice. Prasadam tastes nice. No, all right. So, what can I tell you?
Very good.
You have a sense of humor, too.
I
taught you. Srimati Radharani and Tulsi Devi. So, anyway, so Tulsi Devi, you know that whole story about Tulsi Devi, how she got cursed, became a bush. Yeah, so. She's called also Vrinda Devi. She's in charge of the Vrindavan forests. And she makes all the arrangements for Radha and Krishna's conjugal loving affairs. She makes arrangements for the weather, the trees. She has monkeys who listen to her. That's her army. There's one time Krishna's flute was stolen by Radharani. And that flute was later taken by Jatila, Radharani's so-called mother-in-law. And they couldn't figure out how to get the flute back. So Vrinda called for Kakati, this old monkey. And Kakati went into the house of Jatila and started to tear apart the whole house. And then Jatila didn't have anything to throw at Kakati, the monkey. So she didn't have anything in her hands. So finally she threw the flute. And then Kakati grabbed the flute, made some faces at Jatila and ran away with the flute. He gave the flute back to Krishna. So that's Vrinda. She arranges for all these interesting things. And Srimati Radharani, she's the queen of Vrindavan. Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshri Vishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye. She's Kanchana Gaurangi. She's golden. And when Krishna wants to understand her love, he also takes her complexion. He becomes golden as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And Srimati Radharani is the reservoir of all love for Krishna. She's called the Adi Shakti, the original potency of the Lord from which all the Shaktis expand, and Ladini Shakti. That means she gives pleasure to Krishna. So we're all servants of Srimati Radharani. I think that's esoteric enough. Okay? Does that answer your question?
Somehow, I don't know, is Vrinda Devi...
Vrinda Devi is expansion of Radharani.
Yeah, this.
Yes, Vrinda Devi is expansion. All the Shaktis are expansions of, ultimately, Srimati Radharani. All the goddesses of fortune, all the Lakshmis. And then ultimately in this world, Durga expands from the goddesses of fortune, just like Lord Shiva expands from Vishnu. So they're all expansions like that. Radharani is the original Shakti of the Lord. And we're Jiva souls. At least I am. I don't know about you, but I am a Jiva soul, and my desire is to serve Srimati Radharani and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Lord Nityananda. How's that sound? What's that?
If we serve the servants of Vrinda Devi, are we then also serving the servants of Radharani? Is this somehow...
We are meant to serve Srila Prabhupada and his servants. That's the point. Actually, if we serve Srila Prabhupada, who is perhaps the greatest devotee in the modern day and age, not perhaps, he is, then Krishna is pleased. And Radharani is pleased. Like we chant in the Guru Vashtaka every morning, Kunjayuno Radhikeli Sivjai Yayam Vir Yupir Avakshaniyai. The spiritual master is arranging for so many conjugal loving affairs between Radha and Krishna. So we serve Srila Prabhupada's society, and automatically that's there. We're pleasing Brenda, we're pleasing Srimati Radharani, and then we're pleasing Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, Prabhupada is the best servant of Srimati Radharani that we have association with, yeah. Okay? Does that answer the question? So you don't have to worry, you don't have to look around. Let me find the servant of Brinda Devi. Let me go to Brindakund. That's nice if you go to Brindakund. But let me go to Brindakund and find someone who is Brindakund. Let me find a Rasika Bhakta. Let me find a Raghunuga Bhakta. All you guys in the Krishna conscious movement are all just all reverend people. Well, I got news for you all that before you can start thinking of what your Siddhadeya is or all these elevated topics, you have to come to the platform of Nishta. Just like I was talking to Mario before, he was giving a class in Croatia and he was going through the different stages coming up to this devotional service, Ado, Shraddhata, Sahu, Sangota, Bhajanakriya. In other words, in the beginning there's a little faith, after that you associate with the devotees, after that you begin to execute the process of devotional service, after that you start to get rid of these wonderful things called anarthas. After that, you become a little steady in devotional service, but you still always have anarthas or a tendency until you come to the highest stage. They're not absolutely gone until you come to prema. In any case, when he talked about all these different stages, you know, preliminary stages, the devotees got very discouraged. They said, oh, I feel so low. We have to do all that? I thought we could just concentrate on Radha and Krishna and Vrindavan. And that's all we had to do. And they started crying. No, did they start crying? No. They didn't start crying, but I'm being a little bit theatrical. So, the point is, yeah, we have to work hard, samadhi later. And work hard on controlling our minds, being moral and ethical. Very important things. Like I've been studying the subject matter lately, as if you couldn't tell. It's called moral theology. Moral theology means having morals and ethics that connect you with the ultimate goal of pleasing God and going back to Godhead. So morality and ethics means behavior. Basically behavior in this world. You understand ethics? Like ethical principles. Like be kind to animals. Be kind to sannyasis. These are ethical moral principles. So, Christianity talks about this a lot. I was just reading a book about that today. It was really interesting. They said you can define what a moral principle, one way you can define is what the Pope says. I'm not sure if I agree with that. But we have really because you have different popes and they say different things, right? And they also say by what theologians all agree with. That's another. It's really interesting how people define moral theology in different religions. I find it so much interesting. So we define what's moral by what pleases Krishna. And we know what pleases Krishna because it's there in Guru Shastra Sadhu. We have these balances. Sadhu and Guru have to come in unbroken chain of disciplic succession. They can't disagree about basic moral ethical principles, etc. So, in other words, what we do morally and ethically should be based on what pleases Krishna. That should be our standard. And what brings us back to Godhead, and what helps other people go back to Godhead. I mean, these are basic standards. I can analyze the whole thing further in terms of moral theology. But it's important for us to be moral human beings. You know, kind, loving, concerned human beings, like Prabhupada was. I mean, the thing that convinced me to join the Hare Krishna movement, and indeed, I didn't want to join the Hare Krishna movement. I was against joining the Hare Krishna movement. I was trying my best to avoid joining the Hare Krishna movement. But the thing that convinced me was to see Prabhupada's loving mood. That's what convinced me. To actually, if I hadn't met Prabhupada, you know, who knows what I'd be doing right now. Probably be a CEO of Microsoft or something like that. And devotees would be trying to come and see me to ask for a donation. That's what my mother always says that. I just talked to her the other day. She says, what did you do by joining the Hare Krishna movement? You could have been like Bill Gates or Steve Jobs. You know, you lost your opportunity in life. But if I hadn't met Prabhupada, God knows. But it was Prabhupada's loving mood, you know, and really down to, I don't want to say down to earth, but you know, down to earth interaction with people that really convinced me that I wanted to devote my life to him and serve him. Otherwise, I mean, I was already vegetarian, already chanting Hare Krishna, but I certainly didn't want to wear a dhoti. I certainly didn't want to shave my head. And I certainly didn't want to wake up early in the morning. To me, these are the three regulated principles that I had. Wake up late, dress in Western clothes, and have long hair. Those are my three regulated principles. I was a vegetarian already. But it was Prabhupada's loving exchange. You know, Prabhupada's interaction, personal interaction, that really convinced me to be what I am today. And it's that love for Prabhupada that keeps, that is the source of whatever nishtha, steadiness I have too. Because here we're talking about nishtha. But nishtha has to be based on motivation. There's many motivations that one may have. One may have the motivation of liberation, mukti. But that's not steady. The motivation of bhakti, trying to please someone you love, actually a deep love, not just infatuation. We're talking about that today too. What is deep love? Really gets one to be steady. How do I get steady? I just think of what would Prabhupada want? What would he not want? And then I make my judgments on that. That's how you get nishtha. Very simple way to become nishtha. What would Prabhupada want me to do? What would Prabhupada not want me to do? Simple. Just ask yourself. Okay. I guess we should end now, right? We'll see everybody at Mangalarati at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. No, 5 o'clock, I'm sorry. Okay, all glory is to Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Gaura Prabhupada.